The Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, Mondays at 5 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy, and how you can make the most of your own life, right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
We have a new news flare. Every year, the Texas Medication Algorithm Project, or TMAP. TMAP is an effort in the state of Texas to set up a scientific mapping for how to give drugs to patients. When I first heard about it, I knew that this was one more drug company ploy to get you to believe that psychiatric medicating is fine. Now, what's happened is that some TMAP victims have begun to complain, and a whistleblower has come forward. And the message that the state of Texas Attorney General is giving out is that drug companies created TMAP, paid docs who claim to be professors at universities, but not paid workers on the staffs of drug companies. A lawsuit filed in 2004 is moving forward now, and it's particularly aimed at Janssen, the maker of a number of drugs, including Risperdal, that are pushed by heavy advertising and pushed by TMAP. It's no surprise. Everywhere we turn, what looks like science-based medicine, and especially psychiatry, my field, is actually drug company based medicine. And these same docs have spread the TMAP concept, as paid sort of carpetbaggers traveling around the country to numerous other states in the union. And we got huge sales of drugs like Zyprexa and Risperdal and Seroquel that come out of TMAP and really, in most cases, are too toxic to be given to patients at all. There's no other approach to psychiatric medication than utter skepticism as to its foundation. You'll be hearing more and more about this in my show. You can find the latest news coverage of TMAP by going to my Facebook, Peter Bragan. It's a public figure Facebook. Or if you sign up now for our free newsletter, the Empathic Therapy newsletter, you'll get a glimpse of this report, if not the whole thing, on the newsletter. And if you sign up now for the free newsletter, you'll get it in time. You sign up for the newsletter at empathictherapy.org, empathictherapy.org. Now, my guest today. As always, I'm looking forward to this because I only have guests on that I like. People have said, why don't you have on people and have some controversy? Well, maybe if I've been doing this for a couple of years more, I'll think I need a little controversy. But what controversy means is the people who usually get the media attention would be on with me, rather than the people who are really doing what's right. My guest today is Alex Patakos, PhD, thinks of himself as a modern-day Greek philosopher. I hope his economics are better than modern-day Greece's economics, could not resist that. He's the founder of OPA Way, O-P-A Way. And he really believes that the issues are of spirit and mind rather than brain and the nervous system. Really believes that human beings have to search for meaning. And like me, he was influenced by Viktor Frankl, the, I believe, Austrian psychiatrist, whom I have some quarrel with. Maybe that'll come up later in the show, but not with his basic message, which was the search for meaning. Alex, are you there?
I am here, Peter. It's nice to be with you.
Good. Good to hear you. Am I coming across clear to you?
You are. How about the other way?
Yes, fine.
Great.
Well, let's just go right into what is it you're about, sir?
What am I about? My gosh. Fortunately, after having the opportunity to kind of get a feel for, you know, the kinds of things you've been covering on your show, certainly a major part of my work over many years has been to help get people to move away from some of the more traditional, quote-unquote, psychiatric, psychological interventions that personally I didn't feel either were as effective as people were espousing, or that they were interventions that were inappropriate and, in many cases, not even humane. And so a large part of my background started working in the trenches of the mental health systems, both in the military as well as in the community mental health movement back in the days, you know, when that was a very important public policy initiative. And so a lot of my experience started with that, and then it moved quickly into the idea that I wasn't making the kind of systemic changes that I was hoping, working within the mental health system as a service provider and then as an administrator. So I got involved in the politics of mental health, which in itself is an entire, as you know, just based on what you said in your introduction, also very, you want to talk about controversy, very controversial when you start to kind of get people to shift their mindset. And then from there I moved into getting away from the whole notion of mental health, so to speak, and much more into integrated health and wellness, and looking at people's quality of life, both in their personal lives as well as in their work lives. And so that brought me much closer to the work of Viktor Frankl, who, as you know, was the person who urged me to write my book, Prisoners of Our Thoughts. And that book is really an attempt to take some of the core lessons and principles of Frankl's system of logotherapy into the mainstream. And then after working on that, I felt that there was even more of a need to figure out how to help people move along the path to meaning. And so the OPA Way, which you referred to, is really the next iteration, if you will, the next level of development of not only my thinking, but the way that we're practicing how to help people remember that they're personally responsible for discovering the meaning in their life and what they can do to have optimal health and a state of well-being that is a much higher quality. And so I can get into that. So there's kind of a pathway that started from the more traditional modalities, and it kind of moved away from therapy per se into really trying to guide people along a path of personal growth and even spiritual development through many, many years and through many, many evolutionary stages.
Now, you worked for the government. You said you worked for the White House. You've been a consultant to the FDA.
Right.
Is that right?
Correct. Yeah, and I don't have quite the problem. And I realize, I mean, I certainly have challenges with much of what's going on in the industry, particularly, you know, looking at, again, going back to what Frankl was trying to humanize psychiatry. I've been really trying, and he also was trying to spiritualize psychiatry. I'm really trying to kind of look in along the same lines. Not to say that there aren't people potentially that obviously need some sort of psychiatric drug intervention.
Well, you don't have to say that on my show unless you believe it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I do believe it.
I don't take that viewpoint.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are certainly people that I've seen having worked with, and we don't have. I mean, I worked in some of the state institutions in Illinois, for example, when we were still offering different options like lobotomies. So, I mean, you know what I mean? So, and electroshock and so forth. So, you know, on the one hand, we've come a long way, but on the other hand, I don't think it's just psychiatry that's the problem when we start talking about the pharmaceutical industry and the role of FDA. I think our entire society has gotten so addicted and fixated on better living through chemistry that we're seeing that in all aspects of life. So I don't just see that in the sense of, you know, quote-unquote mental health issues. You know, I'm seeing this in all kinds of issues where people are so dependent. Just give me a drug and all of a sudden I'll be happier. Give me a drug and I'll get rid of my pain. Give me a drug and I'll get rid of my fat, you know, and so forth. So it transcends just the mental health system per se, the traditional defined mental health system.
I'm with you on that. Now, I'd like to get really practical with folks.
Sure.
So tell us how you work with people, in what context, face-to-face, on the telephone, in groups.
Right. Right.
Where and how do you work with folks, and how do you help people? How can you help my listening audience find meaning?
Right. Well, I mean, the work that I do has also changed over time as well. I mean, at one point, working, say, within a state mental health institution or in a mental health center many, many years ago, then we're talking about working with a patient population directly one-on-one and in groups. I evolved from there, you know, and I call it an evolution, a transformation, if you will, into working with people both in work environments as well as personally. So on a personal level, I started doing work one-on-one and in small groups like I did traditionally, but I also started doing things like offering seminars and workshops in the workplace and organizations, both government, corporations, nonprofits, to really help not just the mental health, but the overall state of well-being in the work environment, because we spend so much of our time in the workplace, and yet many people kind of almost hang up their spiritual hats, their health hats at the door, and they go in, and they're, you know, I've walked in a lot of organizations, and like a scene from the movie The Sixth Sense, I see dead people. And so part of that work was to help inspire people to give them some tools on how they can find a deeper meaning in their work, as well as in their personal life, because you can't really separate the two, obviously. And so that became kind of through the training and development part. So I went through a long period of time where I was doing many, many workshops and seminars, still do those, but that was a primary focus when I got into the workplace, because a large part of the readership of my book initially were people in corporations and in government organizations. But also do the same thing with individuals. I mean, so I'll have people, they may even come from some of the corporate or government or organizational clients, and they might be an individual. It could be anybody from an executive, a leadership position, or just somebody who is retired or somebody who just lost their job, or just somebody who's going through a life transition, and they've either read my work or they've seen me give a speech someplace or whatever. And so I do take on, you know, individual clients that way. But right
well,
now...
Well, tell me if I come to see you,
yes.
And... I tell you, Dr. Patakos,
right.
I'm a 75-year-old man, and I just don't seem to have a lot of interest in anything anymore.
Right.
Tell me what are you going to do to help me or someone listening? How do you go about it?
Yeah.
I know it's. I'm not trying to put any pressure on you, but
That's
really
okay.
I want to. I think this is incredibly important. See, I'm actually in a total agreement with you,
yes.
But I also know it's not easy, because
right.
The people who come for therapy or come to
right.
workshops, unless they know in advance that it's going to be about meaning, and
right.
or they know Frankl and they know
right.
you have something to do with Viktor Frankl, they're not prepared to think that their suffering is about not having meaning in their lives.
Right.
So how do you help folks?
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't want to sound flippant, but by first saying that I certainly recommend that people read Prisoners of Our Thoughts, my book, because that'll certainly give them not only an introduction
Good.
to the philosophy and work of Viktor Frankl, but it'll also give them a context for the kind of work that I do. So I think that's really an important starting point. And anybody that I see, whether it's an individual or a group, they're always, if they either come to me because they've read my book or they've read an article that I've written or an interview or something, or they come because somebody else has requested that they do that, and then I give them, you know, the material. So that's one.
So by the way, where are you located? I don't have that.
I'm based in Santa Fe, New Mexico, primarily.
A nice place.
Yes. So people come here. They come here from all over the world. They come here for individual work. They come here with groups. We do retreats. And then under this, the auspices of the OPA Way, we're also starting to do the same thing in terms of doing retreats here in Santa Fe as well as in Greece, which I can get into later.
But help me with how we go about helping people find meaning. I certainly found Frankl's book useful.
Right.
He talked about his life. He talked about that particular book. He's got a number, obviously. He talked about the concentration camps, I think, keeping his mother in his heart and in his mind, I think, was one of the things he did. And
One of the reasons that I wrote Prisoners of Our Thoughts is Frankl wrote 32 books, published books, and, you know, maybe hundreds of articles and certainly, you know, graduate theses and dissertations. But one of the reasons I wrote it was to put it in, to put logotherapy within reach of the mainstream and make this something that would end up being a tool for people so they can be self-empowered as opposed to having to go to therapy. I mean, some of the initial speeches I would give to groups of psychiatrists and psychotherapists years ago, I mean, not that many because this book hasn't been out that long, but just a few years ago, were actually not that well received because they saw me as a threat and my message as a threat. Because by empowering people to find and discover the deeper meaning in their existence and so forth, and ask the kind of existential questions that I ask people and these triggers, that perhaps I would be cutting into their billing hours.
Well, of course. So you're undermining the entire system.
Exactly. So trying to break that pattern of codependency was something that was certainly seen as not necessarily desirable by people with a traditional background. But the idea here is to make it practical. I don't want to talk about Auschwitz. I don't want to talk about those kinds of things unless somebody brings it up. The issue is, how do you take the core lessons, the core wisdom of somebody, and I'm starting with Frankl and then I'll get into the OPA Way, but how do you take this core wisdom, put it into a practical context, a set of tools, of questions, of exercises, of insights and so forth that potentially can awaken people to personally understanding their own responsibility, to discovering the deeper meaning of whatever their situation may be, and then most importantly after that is getting into a kind of some guidepost as to how they can get out of that yucky space that they're in. Now, will everybody do that? Will everybody do that at the same time? Of course not. You know that. It's one of the reasons we resort to drugs. We think we can see immediate response. You know, whether we're giving somebody something that makes them drool right away and walk in a stupor, I mean, they somehow think that that's an effect. When you're getting people to entertain a discussion about existentialism and their whole purpose of and their responsibility for seeking deeper meaning in what they do in order to achieve a higher quality of living, that isn't necessarily something that obviously is going to happen very quickly.
Where does love fit into your thinking about the meaning of life?
Pardon me?
Where does love fit into your thinking about the meaning of life?
Frankl would say this, and I totally agree to this. One of the reasons that we resonate so closely to this is that ultimately love is the highest value that we can seek to attain. And so love, and I know that you're the empathic therapy guru, but that's another place where people, you know, in order to show compassion, obviously we need to, you know, to be able to understand and display empathy, and, you know, love has that quality as well. So to be able to resonate with another human being, that's part of the question that we all, and part of the challenge that we all have to ask ourselves, you know, are we willing to do that? And love certainly is something that Frankl was able to see even when he was a prisoner in the Nazi death camps, was able to articulate and feel love for some of the Nazi guards. So, I mean, this is something that, you know, most people would say, my God, we can't do that. I mean, how can we possibly show love? We can't even forgive people for what they've done to us. So I think these kinds of issues, these are questions that there are a set of very penetrating trigger questions that if people are willing, and not everybody's willing to do this, to entertain these. And I ask clients to maintain a journal so they can keep track of their responses to different questions.
I love trigger questions. Can you give us a few trigger questions?
Well, yeah. I mean, I'll just give you like like one set. I call this exercise existential digging. Okay, this is just a quick give quick example. And again, this is, you can find more detail as well as examples of this in Prisoners of Our Thoughts to start. But I ask people to maintain a journal, and this is sometimes especially difficult for men to do. Women have an easier time sometimes to do this, but I'm encouraging men and to do a lot more of these kinds of exercises. And existential digging is basically a series of four questions. And you take these four questions and you apply them, and you need to respond to them whenever you're facing a situation. And I let, you know, the client decide, you know, he or she, which situation is significant enough to go through these four questions. It could be something that is very, very positive experience. It could be something, a situation that turned out to be a very negative one, something that happened at work, something that happened in their personal life. And the four questions are basically the following. I mean, what the first question is, which is the first level of this digging process, is how did you respond to the situation behaviorally? What are the manifestations? Well, you know, your boss told you weren't going to get a promotion. You had a fight with your spouse, your partner. The first thing you did was, you know, you stormed out the room or the office, or, you know, you could have punched the person out. I mean, who knows? You know, I mean, there's a wide range of behavioral manifestations. So write those down. You know, how did you respond? Second thing in terms of the situation is how did you feel about it? So ask, you know, just putting down words. You know, I felt anger, frustrated, elated, disappointed, excited, whatever those words may be. And then the third level of depth of this existential digging process is what did you learn from the situation? Okay, so what did you learn about yourself? What did you learn about your boss, your partner, your wife, your husband, your kids, your neighbor, whatever. And then the fourth one, which is the most difficult one, is now how are you going to grow and develop as a result of that learning from the situation? And by keeping track of those, it may be as simple. I'll give you one simple example. It may be somebody gets cut off in traffic, and you hear stories about people following the person. They're so angry, they follow them for many, many traffic lights or even miles to get out so that they want to get an argument with them or punch them out. All right. That might be the response initially of somebody. 6 months later, 3 months later, if they keep track of how that situation, when it pops up again, if they look at their journal of how they did their, you know, assuming now that they're continuing to work on their meaning mission, which you get into, their entire response, their entire repertoire of response is going to look different, ideally. Where all of a sudden, you know, their behavioral response is, you know, I'm just so happy that I didn't get in an accident. You know, the fact that the person, you know, I'll have to be more alert next time, as opposed to wanting to follow the person down the road. So understanding the deeper meaning is partly as simple as those kinds of trigger questions of making sure that, you know, what was it about me? What is it that I learned about myself? What did I learn about, you know, driving in traffic, driving, you know, dealing with a boss that is a horrible boss to work with? I mean, it might be that your growth and learning is, I hate my job so much, so I really need to move on to something else. Or maybe, you know, I need to, you know, be more appreciative of my boss or my spouse because I realize that I, you know, kind of am quick-tempered and I really misinterpreted what was being communicated to me. I mean, by going through this existential digging process, and I've done this with thousands of people, it's amazing how, and I have people today, I mean, they'll send me an email and say, hey, I just had something happen to me at work, and guess what? It didn't affect me the way it used to affect me.
You know,
I look back at my journal 6 months earlier and how something.
The part of it, I mean, that to me sounds like good, sound psychology on one level, but I'm not sure where this goes to the issues. You know, when I think about the meaning and helping people find meaning, I think about helping folks find what and whom do they truly love, what part of themselves excites them the most. How would they live their lives if they could choose to live their lives?
Yeah.
So I'm thinking in a, and I do this in a very practical way. I mean, I really talk to
people
about
that. And let me push back on you on this because, you know, the issue is here is that, yes, there are different levels of meaning. I mean, Frankl wrote another book called The Search for Ultimate Meaning, and that was actually his doctoral dissertation, and it was really about, you know, really his connection to, you know, his notion of God. It was a very much of a spiritual transformational level of meaning. And he gets into faith and all that kind of stuff. The issue for me, and if you read Prisoners of Our Thoughts, and again, I encourage all listeners to do this, and certainly the same thing with the Oprah Way, is that I also look at meaning in terms of levels. And many of the meanings that I'm talking about even the simple thing that the exercise I've triggered, because you asked me the question about trigger questions, and
yeah.
I don't have one universal trigger question because I'm not God, so I can't really do that for you. But I can tell you that there are what I call many meanings in life. Every moment of our life contains within it a seed of meaning. And it's not just the meanings, the big ahas, it's not just the big purpose of our life, it's not just the things that we love. There's meaning even the things that we don't love. And so part of our responsibility as a human being is to unravel and discover the deeper meanings of even the times that we don't love. I mean, Frankl did not love being in Auschwitz, but there was a deep meaning in his existence and his survival of that experience. And so part of what we need to do is look at the deeper meaning, because meaning surrounds us at all moments until our very last breath. And so it's our personal responsibility. So the exercise that I just shared with you was one small piece of obviously
a large... I'm trying to get a feel of just what goes on. The difference is
I don't want people to think
that searching for
meaning is going to be dependent on finding things you love. I want people to say there's meaning even in their house being foreclosed. There's meaning of losing your job. They didn't love that. But I want them to discover the deeper meaning so they can grow and develop as a result of it and become more resilient and become much more capable.
Alec, can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Slow down a minute. I was trying to get a word in.
All right.
We do have enough. We have
I'm
another half hour.
I'm a very passionate Greek. I want you to know that. So.
Okay. Well, I want you to slow down a little bit and have a little bit more, you know, let's converse a little bit more about this. A couple of things. We're going to go to break in a minute or two.
All right.
I saw Frankl in 1968. I went out of my way to go hear him speak at this quite a large forum. There was a surprising number of people there. And he talked about personal responsibility. And I remember people who were very worried about war atomic war and other things. Now, could it have been 68, or did I hear him much earlier? When did he die?
He died in 1997.
Okay, so it certainly could have been 68.
Right.
Because I think that's the only time I would have been in that position to hear him. And as he talked about responsibility, it just was excruciating for the young people in the audience, because their idea of how to handle life in this time of turmoil and crisis, the one thing they didn't want to talk about was responsibility. And I'm very much with Frankl on that. But two issues I raised with him that I think are relevant enough to the world in general to bring up, and after the break, maybe you could address them. One issue is that he actually at one point wrote that he'd seen people helped in his clinic by lobotomy. And I think, I don't know if you're familiar with that. And that to me is it's a sign of just how difficult it is to remove the psychiatrist from his training and his setting. The other thing about Frankl was he was, from my viewpoint, extremely patriarchal. Really had a male authority viewpoint on life. Maybe that's so, maybe not. It's certainly my view of reading him. But on the other hand, he makes this great contribution. And I think it's part of the problem that it's so hard to be a psychiatrist in any generation of psychiatrists, going all the way back 200 years, to not in your heart in some way be wedded with this ultimate resort in the physical and in authority. And I just deeply believe that the last resort is love or God or your own meaning, and is not in anywhere in what we call conventional psychiatry. So bring the music on, Giselle, and my new and wonderful director in the studio, and we'll go to break.
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan, your conscience of psychiatry. And I'm talking to a very interesting man, Dr. Alec Patakos, who, like his name, thinks of himself as in the tradition of Greek philosophers, which is, I think, a tradition we would all do well in. Especially if we're attempting to help other people in some way find meaning in their lives. at the break, I asked Alec about the issue of Frankl, not just as the great promoter of meaning, which his books meant a lot to me many, many years ago. I haven't looked at them recently. And just his thoughts about that. Alec, you're on.
Yeah, thanks, Peter. And I'm going to try to keep my answers shorter. I know that your questions are very profound and deep, and so I'm going to still try to make this as as concise as I can. In terms of responsibility, you know, the first thing I would say is we have to put Viktor Frankl's life and legacy in context, both in terms of time, you know, the period that he was in, and then secondly, I mean, he was trained first as a neurologist, and so his interest in science, ironically, was a strength, but at the same time, it became somewhat of a liability because his approach to logotherapy has been often attacked on grounds that it wasn't scientific enough, there wasn't enough empirical evidence to show that what he did was more than just touchy-feely, you know, gabble. And so the whole notion of his sense of trying to kind of create a system that was actually scientific, you know, was particularly at that time period, was a very difficult challenge, a formidable challenge. So I just want to kind of put that in context, right, and realize and recognize that he was coming out of not just the conventional medical training and practice, but also in the period he was trying to really be, in the spirit of this network, a progressive at that time. The second thing is that, you know, I would push back from my knowledge of his work and him personally, that I felt that he was much more balanced, and his view wasn't just that we needed some sort of patriarchal system. He was much more balanced in understanding it. But again, we got to put that in the context of the time period and what he was trying to accomplish during the years of his life.
He was I don't mean to put you on the spot, but when was he born?
He was born in 1917.
1917. He grew up in Eastern Europe.
1907, excuse me. Because he was in his 90s when he died.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he grew up in Vienna. He had opportunities to, and I don't want to get totally into this here because there's a long history, and again, part of it is described in short fashion in a chapter in my book. But his story about how he could have left the camps, he didn't, the kinds of things that he tried to do to display what you're talking about in terms of love and so forth. But again, you know, physiologically, he was trained as a scientist, so physiologically, he was also looking for those kinds of things, even though most people would probably say that he was kind of, way out there when it came to the notion of love and conscience and so forth.
Well, there's a tradition going on at the time. He kind of dovetails with Erich Fromm,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The Art of Love, right, from the 50s,
right.
And
right.
There were a number of people that... all of whom have greatly influenced me, and people should mm-hmm. read more of Sullivan, mm-hmm. Maslow.
Right.
He was part of that overall humanistic movement, but he was somewhat unique in being a psychiatrist.
Exactly.
Like me, there ain't many of us who have actually gone on to have some serious thoughts about human nature and human life, and of course he's one of those.
That's right.
Very, very few who did that. Well, what was he like? I think it might be interesting for people to know more about what he was like. You spent some time with him?
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, he was everything that you could imagine in terms of living his life with passion to the very last moment. He saw meaning in everything. I mean, Stephen Covey, who was also greatly influenced by Frankl, wrote the foreword to my book, Prisoners of Our Thoughts, found the same thing in his really excellent foreword to the book. He talks about his last minutes with Frankl in the hospital. And so, you know,
what was it like in Frankl's
life? He was the kind of person, I mean, if you think about transcendence, self-transcendence, I never forget, you know, the first time I was trying to explain the idea of bringing a book out that would kind of bring logotherapy. And it's, you know, a little bit intimidating to talk to the founder of this school. And, you know, his immediate response was how he could help me. It wasn't about him. It wasn't about his legacy. It wasn't promoting his viewpoint. It was, how can I help you? You know, and that to me was one of the most dramatic things that I discovered was that he really did practice what he preached. It was the notion about extending beyond himself that was very dramatic, and that's the seventh principle. There's seven principles in my book, not to be confused with the seven habits of highly effective people. But that was very, very evident. He was a very incredibly spiritual person. He crossed denominational faith-based lines. You would never have known, basically, and wherever he was, that he was a devout Jew, and he was incredibly passionate about his faith. But yet,
I didn't know that. That's so interesting.
Yeah, but he embraced so much.
So he believed in God.
Totally. And he just embraced so much of the things that he writes about. And I highly recommend people read his other works besides Man's Search for Meaning, because that's usually the one that people kind of get drawn to. But like I said, if you look at The Unheard Cry for Meaning, if you looked at his book Man's Search for Ultimate Meaning, you get much more into it, the spiritual side of Viktor Frankl. And he espoused that, but he also practiced that. And it's the same way with his wife, Ellie, who's still alive. I'm still close to the Frankl family. And so, I still stay in touch with them, and they're, among my biggest supporters. And so that, it means a lot to me, and it meant a lot to me to write a book that would do justice and honor his life and legacy. And so it'd be very difficult for me to say anything negative, because he's influenced my life ever since I was a young boy.
Well, I didn't get that, and if I had, I probably wouldn't have even raised the critical issues.
Oh, no, that's okay. No,
quite seriously.
I don't mind controversy.
What about Ellie, his wife? How long a marriage? Did they go way back?
Well, his marriage goes back to pretty close right after World War II. His first wife died in the camps. She was pregnant with their child.
Wow.
So, anyway.
You made a comment in passing that really struck me about he could have left the camps?
Yes. Yeah, he had opportunities because he had been able to connect with a number of the various SS officers and so forth, because they were very impressed. He had people that were not only because he was a medical doctor, but also he actually helped a number of people as a psychiatrist. And so he had opportunities to basically leave the camp. And, of course, he even had an opportunity to leave Vienna prior to even being incarcerated, and he refused to do that.
Now, Auschwitz was not just a concentration camp. It was an extermination.
It was an extermination,
camp.
Yes. And, and he was at three other camps as well. So he survived four camps. But, I would like to kind of bring something to a more positive view here, because I don't want everybody to kind of get depressed and think about all the things. Life does have suffering in it. We don't have to be in a concentration camp. I mean, somebody doesn't get
right.
You know.
Oh, that's a good point. That's
right. So,
Life is hard. Life is very, very, very hard, and everybody has their own fair share. The models of people who transcend... can be so helpful to us.
Yeah, and we see a lot of those unsung heroes today. I mean, there are many of them. You don't have to go to be in prison to have this kind of experience that inspires other people.
Do you have other folks who have deeply inspired you?
Yes, definitely. There have been a number of people who have inspired me over the years. I mean, some obviously are, many of the people in my work now that, since I'm drawing on Greek culture and philosophy, go back to the ancients. I've got people in my family. I've got a number of people I acknowledge in my book. One of the people I mention in there is an actor. Many listeners will remember the name if they're old enough, Clint Walker. But Clint Walker played Cheyenne in the cowboy TV days, and he was also one of the Dirty Dozen in the movie The Dirty Dozen. And he read my book, and he was a major player in my life in terms of, he didn't know me at the time. I got to know him after I wrote my book. But, I used to watch his TV shows and his movies, and his character of really having virtues that really I felt were the kinds of things that I wanted to follow the path became very important to me in my adolescence and my character development. And so it's kind of an irony that today, I can acknowledge somebody who had such a significant, played a significant role in my character development through the TV, which today I couldn't say that because I don't like to watch TV because of the TV programs that are on.
Well, I think that's very, very, very real. I mean, I actually think I first learned that people and families hugged by watching TV as a child. I know I've taken this conversation in a somewhat different direction perhaps than you anticipated. I think that your relationship with Frankl is extremely interesting, and the way you have come to deeply believe in values. And I do think that successful people and happy people and people who do as best they can in any situation come from strong values, and those values involve so much more than their own survival.
Right.
You don't survive, I don't think, in bad situations by just being focused on your own survival. It takes more than that. And I think that, would you agree, that's one of Frankl's lessons?
Yeah, that's definitely one of his lessons. That's also one of the key lessons of the OPA way. And if I can just kind of take 1 second to just,
sure, go ahead.
Just mention this. Everybody's probably heard the Greek word OPA at a restaurant or a Greek festival, or somebody drops a plate and they hear the word and they hear dancing. And so they associate it with kind of an inspiring, happy time. But the OPA for us is also an acronym, and we've kind of created this acronym, OPA, where O stands for connecting meaningfully with others. So the O is in the OPA is others. And so this really deals with notions of hospitality, of treating others, because Greek hospitality has been known for many, many centuries and millennia. It really is something that's very important for how strangers especially are treated. It's also associated with honoring other people. So, you know, you can't really, if you're not an attentive listener and if you're not honoring and respecting other people, it's pretty hard to get to the point of empathy and the point of love and so forth, because, you know, this kind of connection with others in a meaningful sense requires that we honor each other's presence and their human spirit. The P in OPA stands for engaging with deeper purpose. So this, as you can see, relates again with meaning, but it's really knowing thyself, to go back to Socrates. It's about engaging with adate, which is a Greek word, which is really about virtue. It's about excellence. And again, that takes some personal responsibility. And then it's really about engaging with our own sense of well-being. There's a Greek term called eudaimonia that we're writing about that's really about well-being. It's more than just happiness. And then the A in OPA is about embracing all of life with attitude. And so this is the fullness of life. This is the ups, the downs, the sorrows, and the joys. And that's why this notion of love is terribly important, especially, you know, loving ourselves and loving the people that we really care about. But it's also understanding that sometimes we're going to be in situations, because life is just, that's the human condition, where we are suffering, and understanding that we even have to embrace what Zorba the Greek said, the full catastrophe of living, or Nikos Kazantzakis, the author of Zorba the Greek, said it's the full catastrophe of life, of living. And then being able to have an attitude that's fearless. There's a Greek term, aphobia, that we're espousing. It's helping people understand that life can really be exhilarating if we can kind of get through some of the fears that we have that stop us from doing some of the things that we like to do. And then the last kind of piece of that is about, you know, really achieving some high quality life and wellness, which is both wellness in mind, body, and spirit. And that's really what OPA is. And so we've taken some of the ancient philosophers, and we've taken some of the traditional Greek village values, and we've encapsulated that into lessons that people can apply, which takes the search for meaning to a new and different level with a unique, entertaining, hopefully, Greek twist.
Tell me, there's so much gravitas in the way you think about life and the way I think about life, too. Mm-hmm. When did you first start to get a sense that life was a lot about the meaning that you brought to it?
But probably when I was in grade school.
What is your earliest memory about that?
Yeah, my earliest memory is probably about third grade. And I started asking, what was the meaning of my life? I remember actually when I was about third grade, we were living near a state mental institution in New Jersey. And I remember going by and seeing people walking around the grounds and so forth. And I started asking, why are they on that side of the fence and I'm on this side of the fence? And, you know, why are people nice to people in some cases, but they're mean to others? And so I started asking at a very, very early age. And, you know, I've always felt, you know, and my parents, and then later on I had bosses and deans when I was a university professor say that I was possessed, because I had this spirit that really was, you know, not only defiant, but also always questioning the why of life. And so I just remember that back in the days when I was living in northern New Jersey.
It's one of the great puzzles for me as a therapist, as a parent, as a person, is these differences so early on in how people view life, the courage they bring to it, the thoughtfulness they bring to it, the happiness and spirit that they bring to it. It's kind of inexplicable to me. I've never been able to say, oh, I understand all these, why people go in such different ways.
Yes.
Any idea why you became someone who was really became interested in figuring out what's going on in life?
Well, I mean, I don't want to make it sound like it's like I'm taking this too lightly, but you know, I used to tell people over many years in different environments that I felt like I was on, again, it's going to sound strange, like I was on a mission from God. There was something that was my calling. I didn't know what it was, but I knew that I was here for a purpose, and that purpose was my responsibility to discover. And so understanding people, understanding the diversity of people, I mean, even in the mental health system, I remember being at a commitment hearing in front of a judge one day, back when in the days when I was running a mental health program. And I remember having this patient who I really cared about a lot, and I remember the judge asking me about the patient and so forth, and I said, you know, Your Honor, you know, the only difference between this patient and myself is that I have a key.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to leave the facility because I had a key. And
how did the judge respond? If at all.
He thought I was nuts. Almost
he thought you were nuts, too.
Exactly. But the point was is that many of, you know, because I work with some great people, and you talked about people inspiring. I had a psychologist I work with, his name was Walter Fisher, and he wrote a book called Power, Greed, and Stupidity in the Mental Health Racket. And because we work with so many schizophrenics, I had a large number of schizophrenics that were, you know, primarily my patient load. And, you know, basically Fisher saw most schizophrenics as really having problems with living and in living. And if we could just help them live their life, they'd get along a lot better than just by giving them Thorazine.
Oh, my God, yes. Well, nobody lives better on Thorazine. We're finding now, of course, that these drugs shorten life in the extreme. Some studies are showing these neuroleptics shorten life by 20 years. Nobody finds meaning on a psychiatric drug, in my experience. They just sort of are held in place, and over time people tend to have a worse and worse place. I think the majority of people on these medications and in my experience. It's very interesting talking with you about this whole issue of meaning. I don't think it's strange at all that somehow early on you decided that God had some meaning in mind for you or something along those lines.
Yep.
And I think that many people feel that way about life, and I think we should encourage people. In this day and age, One feels embarrassed about saying things like that, but I'm in total accord with you, and I want folks to really get a sense of themselves and what their mission might be, what their purpose might be. And it doesn't mean being reformers in psychiatry. It can mean taking really good care of your children.
Absolutely.
But we do, I think that we do all have missions and purposes, and I think it is a part of a larger design and a larger experience that I call God, a meaningful creator of this catastrophe called life.
Yeah, Peter, if I could just say this real quickly, you know, if you take the word that is the core word of logotherapy, Frankl's system, that's a Greek word. It comes from the Greek word logos. And the Greek word logos actually it means meaning, it means reason, but it also, going back to the ancient Greek philosopher Heraclitus, it actually has spiritual meaning. So it actually is spiritual energy, and it's even been written up more recently as referring to the logos being, you know, being God. And so if you think about this, and you think about some of these words, that's why some of this Greek language is becoming very important to us in translating this with people when they try to find the meaning in their life. You take a simple English word like enthusiasm, it actually comes from two Greek words, and it actually means, you know, manifesting the God or the divine within, the spirit within. And so if somebody's enthusiastic, it doesn't necessarily mean they need Ritalin. It could be that they're really excited about what they're doing, about their life, and it's part of their human spirit that is being displayed.
Well, and the rage that little children feel that gets labeled with all kinds of diagnoses and
uh-huh.
and stifled with drugs, the rage is about meaning. It's about,
mm-hmm.
so often it's about unfairness, which is the
exactly.
beginning of meaning for many children, is that's unfair. Now,
that's
whether
right.
it is or not, and whether we can expect fairness from life is, of course, a larger issue than the child is considering. But a lot of what children struggle with in the beginning is that is that question that begins to look like a justice question of fairness. And it's also part of the beginning of trying to figure out what's the meaning of this.
Exactly.
Why do I get one thing and somebody else gets another, and why don't I get what I want? And I think that these are such important ways to relate to people. In my practice with kids, I work with them about meaning, about the meaning of their lives, what they're doing, what they're trying to accomplish, what they think's fair and unfair, what they think their relationships to their parents and siblings are all about, and I help them find some meaning. I give them a little guidance about being a big brother or a big sister, and children eat up. They just love the idea that there's something important going on around them and in their lives, and that they can play some role in it, and they're often more open. The teenagers are often more open to conversations on that level than the adults who have left the search for meaning behind somewhere.
Yeah, you know, and that's a very important point. As adults, unfortunately, we've got to obviously get to them as well. They're living their life on cruise control or autopilot until it's too late, and all of a sudden, you know, you hear about movies like The Bucket List where they're saying, okay, what's left in my life? I'm facing mortality. What can I do? You know, one other question we can ask people, and this would be for listeners' benefit, is even if you can't answer questions like, you know, what's the meaning of my work, what's the meaning of my life, if you start to ask the reverse question, you know, what is meaninglessness to me? What is meaninglessness about have to do with my job or my personal relationships or my life in general? That typically gets people going as to, you know, getting them unstuck as to what they might be able to do to change course.
I like that. I like that a lot. I think I've not in my memory thought of it quite like that, but I think it's an excellent way to look, to ask the question, if you can't get meaning, what is meaningless?
Mm-hmm.
What is meaningless and what feels meaningless?
Mm-hmm.
And that's very interesting. I might be interesting for myself to think about that after the show when I'm driving home with Ginger along beautiful Lake Cayuga. And ask myself that kind of a question. What do you hope to accomplish in the next few years? And that's what, you only get a minute to say that and remind people where they can get in touch with you.
Well, real quickly, to accomplish this is, one, publish our book, The Opal Way. This is their first book introducing this new lifestyle philosophy. Do speeches, conduct seminars, workshops, retreats about this lifestyle, and also we're going to actually be certifying people to actually facilitate the Opal Way lessons. So that's a big part of what we're going to be doing, spending more time, really inspiring people and aspiring people to see that they can make changes in a positive way in their lives.
Thank you. My guest, Alex Patakos, P-A-T-T-A-K-O-S, and the Meaning Movement. And this is Dr. Peter Bregan urging you really to listen to the questions echoing throughout this show, because your life has a lot of meaning. Your life has got a lot of meaning.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Bregan and his lifelong reform work on www.bregan.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.